Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamers official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Joining me is my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, Kat. How have you been? It's almost spring.
It is almost spring. I mean, it's still February. It's still very cold here. Are you still buried in snow over in snowy Toronto?
Yeah, we got like a total dump of like 15 centimeters, but I like to hold on to hope. The sun is shining today.
You will make it, Nadia, I promise. Here, the sun just came out, the birds are chirping, it's a beautiful, balmy 55 degrees, so...
That's pretty good.
Pretty good time to talk about RPGs, and in this episode, we've got a lot to cover. We're having Jason Schreier on to talk about the latest entry in our top 25 RPG countdown, Suikoden 2, and of course, we're always going to do the mailbag. Many ways to connect to us. Make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever podcaster you particularly like, Stitcher, iHeartRadio. You can also find us on Spotify. You should subscribe to our newsletter, which goes out every Wednesday, where Nadia and I take turns putting out a little essay. We round up all of the RPG news. We have the latest episodes. So you're never missing out on what the Blood God stuff site, what the Blood God has to say in a particular week. And of course, if you're enjoying the podcast, make sure to leave us a review in your podcatcher of choice, because we love hearing from you. We love hearing feedback. And finally, we like to read comments and questions from readers. So either if you have something you want to contribute, either leave a comment on the show notes or send me a DM or on Twitter at @_catbot or some other way. Okay, so before we jump into the main thing, really quickly, a big piece of RPG news, Nadia, Pokemon Gen 8 has been officially announced. It's Pokemon Sword and Shield. We saw very briefly a trailer showing rolling British-style countrysides and three new starters. Nadia, what is your favorite new starter, and why is it the bunny?
Well, yes, it is Scorbunny, which is funny because I consider myself more of a water elemental in terms of a person. But when it comes to Pokemon, I always seem to gravitate towards the fire types. And I guess I just like how cute they are most of the time. And it's this time the Scorbunny is the fire type. And I like rabbits a lot. I love the fact that we have an English countryside and a rabbit, which to me equals Watership Down, except... maybe not quite as bloody, but if they want to make a, you know, Pokemon battles between, like, you know, evil bunnies and good bunnies, like Watership Down style, I am totally here for that.
We're going to have
really
hair.
Cute,
the final evolution will be a hair that speaks in a very posh accent.
Someone was saying that Grookey, the grass type, what if he just evolves into a man? That's all Darwin.
That'd be evolution proven through Pokemon.
There you go. But yes, it is Scorbunny. He is all, like, spunky and stuff, and he's, like, I guess he likes soccer, football. He has a little bandage on his nose, too, which I think is just too much.
I think I might actually pick the salamander. Sobble?
Sobble. A lot of people are really into Sobble because he's, as Mike said, he's millennial anxiety personified.
I mean, I feel like looking at these, for me, it's less about how cute the initial Pokemon is and much more about... what's their final evolution like? Because that's where I put kind of my most stock in. And last generation, I picked a Litten and was ultimately disappointed by the final evolution, Incineroar.
I've
come around to Incineroar because of Smash Brothers mostly, but I think Decidueye was ultimately the winner of the three final evolutions of that game. And I just get this feeling that Scorbunny is going to be a painfully lame final evolution.
I hope not. It's really hard to screw up a warrior bunny. I mean, look at like the Togwell from Fire Emblem, or the the rabbit people.
I hope it's not another fighting fire type, though, because there are like multiple of those. I think Blaziken, Infernape, and Emboar are all fighting fire types.
Yeah, we had a break with Incineroar, who's dark fire. But yeah, I also kind of hope that we don't get another fighting fire. But those big feet, man.
Yeah, we had a psychic fire and a dark fire. Yeah. But I think we can do better. And let's be honest, why do we always start with water, fire, grass? Can't we start with some other type?
I feel like if we did that, some fabric of the universe would start unraveling. It's just
I guess.
A feeling.
You don't want to mess with a formula that just works.
Yeah, yeah. And that seems to be the case here. Like, they're clearly not messing with what works, which is fine, Pokemon.
Looking at the trailer, some of my impressions, it's a lot prettier than Pokemon Let's Go just off the bat. It's clearly a graphical upgrade, which kind of puts to rest one fear, which was that they were just rolling out the engine for Pokemon Let's Go and then using again for Pokemon Gen 8 with a new region. It is actually a really lovely looking game. It's clear that they're really going all out on this one. It's funny, the comparisons to Forza Horizon, the most recent Forza Horizon, because that also is set in the UK, sort of. I like the idea of being able to take the Chunnel over to Kalos, which is set in Europe, the continent.
That would be amazing. I'm hoping for that. It probably won't happen, but that would be really awesome.
I was observing in the Axe of the Blood God newsletter, which you should subscribe to, by the way, that this is a really critical entry mm-hmm. for Pokemon, because this is where it is basically transitioning to console. And in transitioning over to console, it's going to have very different expectations. People are going to be judging it from the standpoint of a game like Assassin's Creed Odyssey or The Witcher 3. Fair or unfair, because it is going to be, I believe, a $60 packaged game, right? So it's going to need to have a lot more solo content. It's going to need to have a full suite of online options. Mm-hmm. It's going to need to nail the presentation. So far, it's nailing the presentation. It's looking really good. It seems to have a sweep and a scope to it that previous games don't have. I'm really keeping my fingers crossed that we're going to go to another region in the end game. We'll see. But I think, Nadia, my main demand for this game is more good high-level solo content. Please stop trying to pass off battles against level 70 Pokemon as endgame. That's not endgame. I have years worth of level 100 Pokemon. That stuff is trivial. Give me an actual challenge.
Yeah, as usual, it's the pining for a good... I think I mentioned this in my piece that I wrote about the game, the trailer. We want that really good solo content for post-game, because not all of us want to fight online. And especially since I feel like Nintendo is going to roll out the whatever plan they have for the Switch next in terms of a new iteration. They're going to kind of roll it out to be alongside the new Pokemon, just maybe something more portable, the way the DS was, the 3DS was.
I guess we'll see. Well, I mean, we'll find out more as time goes on. I wonder how long they can keep introducing Pokemon. I guess they're just going to just keep introducing them until we have literally thousands of them.
Oh, my God.
Because there's no reason to stop.
Apparently not.
And everybody has their favorite generation. Everybody has their favorite monsters at this point. They're so insanely marketable from a plush toy standpoint. I think we're going to crack 1,000 with this generation.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. Do you know where we are right now?
I think we're in the, last time I checked, we were in the 700 range. So
maybe
we might jump into the 850s or the 900s, but we're almost to 1,000.
We're almost to 1,000. We definitely are. Oh, wow, remember 150? Oh my God, how to memorize all of these.
I remember when 386 was too much.
Yeah, they really have slowed down introducing new ones, which is fine with me. Especially since...
Well, I think at this point they should go for quality over quantity.
Exactly.
Like, just really...
Exactly.
Really just focus on making a winner. Like, no more love discs is what I'm saying.
Nobody, well, poor love disc. But love disc is handy. You can steal their scales.
So I'm genuinely, I know, like, every year I'm on my own version of the Pokemon cycle, in which I'm like, I'm very excited for Pokemon, and then I play it, and then I'm like, I'm out of Pokemon. I'm never playing Pokemon again. Grr, 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 grr. Well, I am very excited about this version, not the least because it's on Switch. It's just going to naturally be bigger. I'm more or less out on competitive play at this point because I don't like the metagame and I just don't have time to sit and breed new monsters and everything, and it's a little too intense for the amount of time that I have. But give me some really high quality solo content like the Battle Frontier and I'm all in. Like I just want to have an excuse to use my old monsters on fun, interesting battle specific challenges. But
yeah.
All right. So Pokemon Gen 8, Pokemon Sword and Shield, and my axe will be out later this year on the Nintendo Switch, and it's certainly going to be one of the most interesting games of the year. Mm-hmm. I have every confidence that Game Freak will nail it. It'll sell an insane amount of copies. It'll be one of the biggest games in the Nintendo Switch. Another true killer app for the system. Nadia, did you have any additional thoughts?
As I wrote recently, I'm a little bit let down about what seems to be random encounters are back. But
I'm not surprised, though.
I'm not surprised. Disappointed.
Yeah, I think that they wanted to experiment a little bit with Pokemon Let's Go, but they're more or less going back to what hardcore fans are expecting to
exactly.
see.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think there are plenty of people who are like me and are like, nah, screw random encounters, have them on the field. But there are plenty of more people who are like, no, I like the surprise element of random encounters.
Yeah.
I think that if they had killed random encounters forever, it would have been very divisive.
You got a point there, because when I wrote my piece, actually, I was surprised how much pushback there was. People seemed to really like them, and it's like, okay, fine, we'll negotiate. Just don't give me 1,000 Zubats every time I step into a freaking cave.
I think just Pokemon Let's Go was a proof of concept that it does work, and it works extremely well.
Yes.
And it doesn't lose you the excitement of seeing something. If anything, it enhances it, because you suddenly see a rare Pokemon bound out of the bushes and you're like, I'm gonna get that.
That's true. And as long as I can ride my Arcanine on like the rolling hills of England, quote-unquote England, I will be happy.
Oh god, they gotta bring that back.
They're really
not gonna
do.
Go back to the old HM system. You're gonna be able to ride Pokemon.
I hope so. Yeah, I really
though
love that.
Probably you won't be riding Arcanine. You'll be riding some whatever they have there that's the equivalent.
I hope not. Like, I mean, they had like...
It'll be like a Rapidash or something.
Rapidash is okay, but Arcanine's better.
Yeah, they're gonna bafflingly cut a lot of the positive features from Pokemon Let's Go. It's going to be annoying. Like the ability to ride like practically every Pokemon.
Yeah, and those are some great ride-on Pokemon. Like, you can read my article I wrote about like the ones you can ride on, and a lot of them are hilarious. It's like... I didn't realize how huge Haunter is until I did that.
I saw somebody tweeting that they had an extremely bad take, which is that, in their opinion, Pokemon has an outdated battle system.
Yeah.
And that it should go to something more like Final Fantasy XII, and I almost had an aneurysm. What are you even talking about? The mechanics of Pokemon are timeless. The actual combat is perfect. Like, menu-driven... role-playing, menu-driven, turn-based, command-driven battle systems are not by themselves archaic.
Mm-hmm,
they work
exactly.
extremely well because they have really deep and interesting tactical hooks that draw in people like me who aren't actually that much into action games. And there's a reason that there is such a persistent competitive community, why people are so obsessed about the metagame, why there's a Pokemon competitive championship. It's not an eSport, but it exists, and it happens every year, and it gives out prizes, and it brings in people all around the world.
It does.
And that is, the game is extremely deep, and it is fueled by the battle system. So don't ever tell me that they should ditch the battle system, because the battle system is the core of what makes that game work, and if they ever got rid of it, I would be I would be extremely done with Pokemon at that point.
Yeah, it's like you and everyone else. I mean, it's one of those situations where it's like, well, okay, if you don't like something, that's fine, but... If Pokemon has been so tremendous, so tremendously popular for so many years, it's got to be doing something right, and probably shouldn't mess exactly with what that thing is.
That thing that's doing right is marketing.
Well, yeah, and as I look at my Arcanine plushie and my Ninetales plushie, it's like, yeah.
Yep, a lady in her mid-30s, definitely has some Pokemon stuff around, because we just never grew up in this business, but... All right, we are running out of time. I mean, we got a lot to cover, so we're going to jump over to the next segment. So don't go away. All right, we're back with the top 25 RPG countdown, and we are now into the top 5, getting ever so close to being done with this project, finally. And number 5 is a classic RPG from Konami, and that is Suikoden 2. And joining us is a special guest, probably the biggest Suikoden 2 boaster in the games press, and that is Kotaku's Jason Schreier. Welcome back to the show.
Hello. Thank you guys for having me. You guys said Suikoden 2, and I was like, well, I just got to drop everything and come on. So it's very easy to get my attention. All you have to do is say Suikoden 2, and I will run. I will come running.
Jason loves is breaking all of the news in the industry, but really, he's been training his entire career for just this moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I could break news on Suikoden 6, that's really all I ask for in this world. I'll just retire then and there if I could report on Suikoden 6 actually happening. But no, it'll never happen because Konami is just a pachinko company now.
Did you ever play The Alliance Alive?
I played like an hour of it and was not for me. That style of just like, I don't know, tedious turn-based gameplay was just not my vibe, I would say.
Well, Suikoden 2, of course, is the PlayStation RPG, the sequel to Suikoden, and it was developed by Yoshitaka Murayama's team, and it's funny because he was supposedly given a pick between a baseball game, a racing game, and an RPG. He ended up going with the last, thankfully. Apparently he would have rather have done a shoot 'em up. He was a shoot 'em up fan. Some of his inspirations included Fist of the North Star, Captain Tsubasa, that would be the soccer manga, and the Chinese novel Outlaws of the Marsh, aka Water Margin. And of course, Outlaws of the Marsh was the main comparison to the original game. It's the story of 108 outlaws who gather to form an army and are eventually granted amnesty by government and go on campaigns to resist foreign invaders. In the case of Suikoden 2, you are recruiting the 108 Stars of Destiny, and you're in a much more fantasy-type scenario. So the question that I have for the two of you is, how did you get into Suikoden, and what does it mean to you? Why don't we start with Jason?
Yeah, well, so I don't remember exactly when I picked up Suikoden 1. It must have been my parents buying for me at Toys R Us or something like that. I remember the box art was ridiculous looking. It had all these realistic people on it in that true 90s style box art fashion. And I remember it was probably one of those games where I was just like killing time between Final Fantasies, like looking for a new RPG to play between Final Fantasies. And I remember it kind of blew me away, and my young mind was blown by the possibilities and the gameplay and the story and the emotions, and going around collecting people and recruiting members to join your army. It was all incredible. And I'm not sure when I realized there was a Suikoden 2. I think it was one of those things where like I had no idea that there was a sequel coming. I just happened to see it at Toys R Us or something like that and was like, Mom, can I please have this? Maybe by then I was old enough to buy my own games. I don't really remember. It was, what, 99? Or 98. And I got that, brought it home, and that game just, like, totally blew me away. Like, if Suikoden 1 was good and great, I would say, but Suikoden 2 was, like, friggin' mind-blowing, and just everything about it, the packaging and the story and the way that it feels to play and the way that it just resonated with me was really special, and it just stuck with me, and I kept playing it over and over again just to see all the little quirks and things. I got the strategy guide so I could recruit everybody without missing anyone, because there were some that were easy to miss, and yeah, I just fell in love pretty much right away.
Yeah, I was always sad because I missed out on Suikoden 2 when it first came out, which is funny because it was right around the time that I was starting to get into JRPGs. And I didn't even know that Suikoden existed until I started hearing a lot of hype for Suikoden 3 on the PlayStation 2. And I was like, wow, this sounds like a really cool idea. I would love to get this game, Suikoden 2, for the PlayStation, which looks, and oh my God, it's like $300. Okay, that's not going to happen. Yeah, and I was a poor college student. Yeah, I just didn't have the money. My equivalent of Suikoden 2 for listeners of this podcast will know is Valkyrie Profile, which was another obscure RPG in which you recruit party members from across the world, in this case, the Land of the Dead. And I ended up picking up just in time and was taken by the incredible sprite art and everything. So I always figured that if I had been if I had gotten into RPGs like 6 months earlier, I might have picked up Suikoden 2 just in time, but alas, it was not to be. Nadia, how did you get into Suikoden 2?
It's funny, I actually picked up the game when it was like fresh and brand new, like, you know, a newborn baby. I had just picked up Final Fantasy VIII, and I was so mad at the game because, as Kat knows, and as listeners of the Axe of the Blood God know, I kind of got very irritated at Final Fantasy VIII very quickly. And and I was very mad at this game, and I was telling a friend of mine how mad I was, and she said, well, you know, it's a great game, Suikoden 2. Why don't you go ahead and pick that up? So I said, oh, okay, I'll go ahead and do that. So I went back to the store. I didn't return Final Fantasy VIII. I just kind of had that spark of hope in my heart. I just hang on to it. But I picked up Suikoden 2 because I was living at home and had, you know, money to throw around like an idiot. And I just fell in love with this game, even though I hadn't even so much as heard of Suikoden 1, because I got my PlayStation a little bit late and I was still kind of into the really well-known RPGs like Final Fantasy. I wasn't experimenting so much with the outside of my comfort zone. But I just took it home and was just like blown away practically from moment one. I mean, you're talking about a game where you put it in and within the first, God, like 10 minutes, there's this brigade of children getting slaughtered for political means. I'm like, holy shit, what the hell am I playing? I love this. It was an awakening.
Yeah, that was the beautiful thing about RPGs in the late 90s was it had subject matter and kind of more mature stories. I mean, I put mature in air quotes than a lot of what you were getting at that time. I mean, if you look at kind of the array of stuff that you had in other genres, you still had a lot of mascot platformers and stuff. Uh-huh. And we were starting to get horror games in large measure with Silent Hill and Resident Evil, but they were still extremely new. So if you wanted really interesting, good storytelling in video game terms, then you went to RPGs. And I think Suikoden 2 was certainly maybe one of the gold standards for that. But Suikoden 1, of course, came out in 1995, and I think the thing that really stood out about it was that it did not go with 3D graphics. Instead, it went with 2D graphics, and I think that is a huge part of Suikoden's ultimate appeal and why it is held up so well. Would you agree, Jason?
Yeah, for sure. If you go back and you replay, actually, I just was messing around a little bit with Final Fantasy IX on Switch because that just came out, and it looks okay, it looks good, yeah. But certainly does not compare to the 2D games of the time, which have just aged so much better because that blocky 3D that seemed so fresh and new and innovative back in the 90s and the early 2000s today just kind of looks like antiquated. It looks like obsolete. It looks like you're playing a super old game. Whereas Suikoden 2 could pass for a modern day game because it's on the very far high end of the spectrum as far as 2D graphics, and that it's very detailed and elaborate, and the animations are all incredible. And it all just feels very handcrafted with a lot of love. Whereas polygonal stuff just does not pass the test of time nearly as well as we saw with the PlayStation Classic, which seemed to tank right out of the gate, which is for a lot of reasons, but I think one of the big ones is that PlayStation 1 games, for the most part, all those 3D games have just not aged as well as 2D style games.
Yeah.
Do you think the PlayStation Classic would have succeeded if, for example, it had good word of mouth, decent emulation, and a much better lineup?
Everything.
Yes. I mean, that's a whole combination of factors. But I do think that in general, like if you look at the NES and SNES Classic, those games have aged better just as a general rule than PS1 games, and especially Super Nintendo games. NES was kind of like the era of like experimenting and not really knowing what video games are and what they should be. But Super Nintendo especially, and I think that the Suikoden and Suikoden 2 and the Lunar games and Wild Arms and some other 2D style games for the PS1 have that same sort of feel as the Super Nintendo games. And I remember even at the time I was very big on, like, oh my god, these 3D games don't even look nearly as good as Suikoden 2 does.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, even though they were pushing the limits of what technology could do at the time, I think just artistically and just they didn't play as well.
The thing about Suikoden 2's sprites is it's not just that they're 2D, it's that they're extremely high quality the really fluid in the way that they animate. I mean, you point that out a lot, Nadia.
I do. One thing I've said in the past on Twitter is just the opening movie, which is the music title with it is titled Reminisce, and it's just what I refer to the cutscene just for convenience and sake. It's just, I still look back on it and I'm just like, want to cry because it's, number one, it's beautiful. Number two, it's just like, we will never see sprites like this again. Of course, you know, indie developers in particular seem to embrace sprites, but a lot of those are more of the high definition sort of sprites, which look incredible, don't get me wrong, but just that pixel by pixel love that Konami put into 108 characters plus a few more. All with their individual attack animations, individual, you know, magic casting animations, expressions, name it. That's just, I shudder to think how much work, how much of their life someone poured into all that.
Yeah, no kidding. And the sad thing was that we didn't really appreciate that back in 1999.
No, we really didn't.
Yeah, Suikoden 2 came out at the same time as Final Fantasy VIII and the Dreamcast. And of course, everybody was totally obsessed with polygons and 3D graphics and everything at that time, and I would say that it would take a solid more than a decade before we really started to appreciate again what 2D sprite work could actually bring to the table. And unfortunately, while it has done more than anything to make Suikoden 2 continue to be relevant and hold up, it also was maybe a bit of its downfall back in the late 90s.
Could be.
Yeah, but the good news is that it still holds up and feels mm-hmm. incredible today. Like, this game has aged remarkably well, and it is very playable, even if you've never even played a PlayStation 1 game before. It's like very much like go and get it on your Vita or your PS3. I think those are the only places you can get it now, PSP, Vita, and PS3, or just get an emulator or whatever. I won't judge you. it's worth playing, and it has aged really well.
Yeah, buy a PS3 just for this game. It's worth it. So let's talk about the game itself. Suikoden 2 continued the formula from Suikoden 1. Suikoden 1 was kind of a test run, actually. And Suikoden 2, you might call Suikoden 1 a prologue. Suikoden 2 was bigger in pretty much every way. It had better graphics, music, more rune slots. It included important updates like the shared item menu, but more importantly, it was just bigger. It had three major characters. It had Joy, Nanami, and you, the main character, and it's a story of betrayal and politics and empires and truly evil characters like Luca Blight, and there is a sweep and a scope to this game that befits the fact that it has 108 characters. Jason, why don't you talk me through kind of the story a little bit and why it works so well?
Yeah, this is, I mean, as you said, it's a story. I like to describe it as Game of Thrones meets Pokemon, in that it's got the scope and the scale of a Game of Thrones with all the political machinations and betrayals and backstabbing, as well as the just pure joy and collection of a Pokemon game. It's a story that I think is without getting too spoilery for people who want to play this and are curious about it, it's a story that works because it does things that you could only really do in a video game, and it has some really special moments that kind of intersect with the way that the game actually plays, that make it just feel really unique and special. And just moments like first meeting Luca Blight, who's the main villain of the game, actually fighting against your various encounters against him, and then the relationships between the three main characters are just pretty hard to beat. They're pretty just incredible. They're just really well-rounded, deep, interesting characters who just have these relationships that feel very real and very human and very complicated, and the story does these characters justice.
Well, it begins with a betrayal, and so the main character, you early on befriend Joey, and it seems like he's going to be the character that's going to be by your side throughout most of the game, along with Nanami, and then Joey totally betrays you in the most terrible way possible, and you're like, well, oh, okay, so now he's a villain, but what the heck is going on with this character? And Joey is a complicated character because he does have some redemption at the end. He can have redemption. But I've always kind of been of the impression that he really crosses the moral event horizon the moment that he murders Annabelle. What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, I think I wasn't going to get too spoilery, but now that we've crossed the Rubicon, the spoiler Rubicon.
Yeah, we crossed the moral event horizon of spoilers.
Yes, I think that one of the really interesting things is just like trying to, the game kind of lets you decide for yourself whether you want to forgive Joey, whether you want to sympathize with his motivations, because he does have interesting and complicated motivations for doing the things, the horrible things that he does. And I think that the game explores those in some really interesting ways and asks some questions that I don't think have easy answers. And by the end of it, you can wind up... you can wind up reconciling with your former best friend, and the three of you can run off together and go on an adventure and live happily ever after, going back to being friends again, forgetting about everything that happened. But the game asks you to think about these things a lot and kind of makes you reckon with what Joey has done and what you have to do in order to fight him. And you hit some real lows in this game. And that's one of the really interesting things about it, is that it can take you to the climax and the highs of defeating Luca Blight and figuring out what Joey's up to and getting back together with him and all the special moments that happen along the way. You really just have some real low points, like discovering that your best friend has just betrayed you and murdered the mayor who you were there helping protect. That's what makes it such an interesting story, is that it doesn't really frame things in black and white. Even the main character, the main villain, Luca Blight, who is like this personification of all things evil, he has some layers to his backstory, and if you read up on some of the game's subtext and read up on some of the supplementary materials that are floating around the internet, you can see that even Luca Blight is like driven by this event from his childhood that made him hate humanity, which is kind of a
messed up backstory. It wasn't just the fact that he was what had happened, if I can just go ahead and say it, as far as I know, is his mother.
Spoiler.
His mother was, he and his mother were kidnapped by, was it citizens from your side of the story, Harmony, I believe, who basically kidnapped and raped her repeatedly. And that's how she actually got pregnant with Luca's half sister, Julia. And that made him hate your side of the, you know, the quote unquote good guys. So you can kind of definitely see there's that, those layers of gray there. Of course, he's out of his freaking mind, but he.
Yeah, he's also a psychopath.
He's a complete freaking psychopath. Anyone who has that portrait, like that look in his eyes, is just do not cross. But there is definitely not just a matter of, as much as I love Kefka, he is definitely, I am evil because I just, you know, hate everything. I want everything to disappear. Luca is not like that. He has his own machinations. He has his own designs. He is just out of his mind, which actually makes him a little more terrifying than Kefka, because he is very much the leader of a major nation, and he knows how to get shit done, and he's crazy.
So there's often a discussion about, is Luca the best, most evil JRPG villain? And often he is compared directly with Kefka, and I kind of want you guys to weigh in. Luca or Kefka, who you got?
Well, Luca is more... Well, I don't know. Kefka is more successful at
That's
his
true.
Evil goals, and Kefka certainly has no qualms with just murdering innocent people. But Luca seems to take more joy in just like forcing people to just like. Slaughtering people indiscriminately, like slicing off their heads, doing the dirty work himself, as opposed to Kefka, who seems to like to use poison and magic and giant laser beams to serve his goals. That's a tough one. They're both pretty nasty folks.
Yeah.
Kefka does have memorable lines like, son of a submariner, though.
He does, but Luca has die
that's
pig.
True. Although I think that was changed in recent versions to son of a sandworm.
Oh, no. Nadia, what do you think?
I see where Jason's coming from. And I think it's a little bit different because Luca, yes, he gets his hands dirty himself. And not just that, but Kefka achieved godhood. Luca was a major thorn in your side and slaughtered millions, but he did it all himself. Like, he never ascended. He was just this badass in armor who could just take a million arrows, stand back up again, spit in your face. You shoot him down again. He's still crawling towards you, like scorning you. He would not stay down. And I think, as I said, he might be a little more frightening, especially in this current political climate that we're in, where he's out of his freaking mind, but he is in charge of a major nation and he knows how to run it. He's just, you know, evil. He cares nothing for his people. He just cares about power, acquiring that power and using it to make himself more powerful and make people under him miserable.
And he probably has some of the single most evil element, just moments by themselves, right? I mean, Kefka poisons water and he murders a beloved character and he sits on top of his tower nuking the planet just because. But, I mean, Luca takes a woman and forces her to act like a pig in the middle of her burning village while all of her friends are dead. I mean, just in... we're talking about, like, mass acts of horror versus that singular moment of, like, geez, Luca's really messed up dude, isn't he?
And then he laughs. Die, pig.
The fight against him is certainly memorable. I would say the fight against him 100%. Is better than the fight against Kefka.
Sure. Yeah.
Kefka uses all these his three goddess minions before he can even take you on. While Luca, you have to battle on three subsequent fights, and even then, even after killing him normally in normal combat, it still takes like dozens of arrows and a one-on-one duel to really finish him off. So he has Kefka beat in terms
of Luca climate. Is one of those villains who you are terrified to meet, and when you do meet him, he very much justifies that terror because he is a tough fight.
I think the final battle, which has multiple parts, he never turns into he never obtains a new form or grows wings or whatever. He's just a tough bastard who is extremely difficult to bring down, and top five moment in RPG history, that entire battle. Like, what do you guys think?
Yeah, it's up there. It's certainly up there. Certainly one of the best battles.
I just
RPG
like it
history.
So much because of the fact that, like, when you take down a villain of his caliber, you usually get like the sniveling, "Oh, you know, please don't hurt me. It wasn't my fault." Blah blah blah. He is to the end. He is just unrepentant. I just like love that about him. He owns his total bastardness and the fact that he's quite a schemer. Like his plan with Joey and the poisoned blood. And to slay his father, that was, in JRPG plan terms, that was a pretty good plan.
Yeah, although it seems like most of that was Joey's doing.
That's true.
It seems like Joey was the big schemer when again. Joey and Leon Silverberg was the strategist that Joey winds up teaming up with, who's actually a recruitable character in the first game. Interesting connections. There are all sorts of connections between the first game and the second game. So if you're thinking about playing this game, I hope you turned off this podcast by now since we're
sorry.
But if you're thinking about playing it and you want the full ride, you need to start with the first one because there are just so many connections between
that's
the two
true.
Games. And I think that's one of the reasons that people love the Suikoden series so much is because they're all so connected that it feels more like one ongoing TV series, sort of like a Game of Thrones, than it does just a series of games like a Final Fantasy, where every entry in the series is just a total reset and you can just jump in or out at any point. This is more like, no, this is all set within the same world and there are ongoing plot threads. And I think that sort of like investment and reward is one of the reasons that people love it so much, and also one of the reasons that it's so irritating that Konami has abandoned the series because there are so many plot threads that have been just left unresolved. It's sort of like if the writer of Game of Thrones just decided to stop writing new books. Who could imagine that happening, right?
That would never happen. You're a New York Jets fan, right, Jason?
Sure am.
It's your team's dang fault that we haven't gotten the new book. He's too busy watching the Jets and blogging about them.
George R. R. Martin is both a Jets and a Giants fan, which like, yeah, that's unheard of here. Like, that's not, nobody's okay with that. Like, New Yorkers. Yeah, that's just not okay. So nobody really thinks that nobody's like sympathizing with his football allegiances. Like when he blogs and he has this live journal that he updates with football updates, he always talks about the Jets and the Giants and how he's sometimes happy that the Giants won and the Jets didn't. And it's just like, no, come on. Come
weird.
On, George.
That monster.
Yeah. Sort of like being a fan of like the Starks and the Lannisters. I mean,
Let's talk about the 108 Stars of Destiny really quickly. Murayama subscribes to the philosophy that protagonists move the plot forward, but the supporting characters are always the most memorable. And honestly, I'm not going to disagree, because it always seems like the ensemble dark horse, the Sixth Ranger, is the one who is the most popular. And when you look at the 108 Stars of Destiny, you just inevitably are going to end up picking some of your favorites, because there's a little bit of something for everybody. I'm just curious, who is your favorite Star of Destiny? How about you, Nadia?
Let's see. Outside of the of Joey, who I had a major crush on when I first played this game. Yeah. I chose the wrong horse, didn't I? I think, this is silly, but I think one of my favorites was Gengen, the kobold. I love the kobolds in that game. Oh my god, they're actual dogs. Like, when their battle cries are just barking. I think that's amazing. I also love what the unicorn. I can't remember its name. I think it was Siegfried.
Yes.
Just the fact that you had this unicorn who was vicious. You never see that very much in literature or video games or anywhere.
Murdercorn.
Yeah, yeah. You had to, like, catch this thing by using, like, a virgin as bait. And I think there's that one character who sleeps around and, like, you know, you could, like, suggest using her and everyone would laugh you off. Yeah, you catch his unicorn by, like, you know, kind of baiting a trap with an actual virgin. And just when it, like, catches up to you, it's just, like, talks like a freaking monster. I'm like, holy hell, what's wrong with this unicorn? I love it. But I love that, and I like the dog Shiro. So those were my favorite.
A lot of good animals.
I kind of have a thing for, like, well, I used to, as people listeners of the podcast know, I used to be a groomer, so I used to work a lot with animals. But I've always had an affinity for them, for going for the sort of monstrous types.
Nice. Yeah, the problem with animals in this game is that they take up two combat slots and they're never actually worth using.
Except Shiro.
Yeah, I have a lot of favorite characters. My favorite character changes all the time. I'm partial to Sasurai, who is has a very small role in 2 and shows up more in 3. I like some of the mage characters, like Mazis. I like Pezmerga, who's this. Yep, I like Pezmerga's a lot of the mysterious characters. Big fan of George Prime. Big fan of Hi-Yo, who's the chef, who's this goofy dude who comes in and gives you an entire Iron Chef-style minigame, which is incredible. This game contains magnitudes. A lot of the characters are just very, very good.
We have to talk about the cooking minigame really quickly. I mean, it's up there with Triple Triad, right, Jason?
I don't know about that. I certainly Ooh. Love it, and so it has a great story, but the problem is that you don't actually do anything. You're just like you just stand there and mash the A button. Like, it's cool, but it's not really, as far when it comes to a game, it's just not very good. When it comes to personality and story and the fact that it exists, the charm of it all is incredible. But Triple Triad is like an actual game where you're making interesting decisions. This is not.
Fair point. But what is the appeal of this? Like, talk us through it really quickly.
Of the cooking game?
Yeah.
Well, so it's got this flourish where, like, you and you're the sous chef to Hi-Yo, who's your chef character, and sometimes when you come into his restaurant, it'll be like there'll be an event, and you'll have to start a cooking competition where you battle against some chef who is, like, there's this whole elaborate story where Hi-Yo has this backstory involving other chefs, and all these different chefs come in to challenge him to one-on-one Iron Chef style battles, and so you pick a bunch of meals, and then you serve them to a host of judges who are picked up. The judges are picked from the people you've recruited, so it'll be 4 of your characters as judges, and you have to decide based on what you think they'll like. So, like, some of them like sweets, some of them like salty food, and so you're making up a meal for them, and then you just mash the X button to make actually cook the meal. And then it's the plot is like insane. It's like the super hokey, like emotional, like full of poison and drama and like soap opera style backstabbing. And it's like a mini little story within the game itself. It has nothing to do with the game. It's all totally optional. But yeah, it's just another little fun thing that happens in this game. I mean, one of the big appeals of Suikoden that we haven't even mentioned is that you always get your own base, your HQ in Suikoden 2. It's a castle. And you get to fill it up with people who you recruit, and then you can go around and talk to them. Some of them open shops, some of them give you mini games you can do with them, and it's all just really elaborate and intricate and really.
It's just an interesting aside here. Do any of you remember that kind of Epic Mickey game that was on? I don't know if it was 3DS or DS. Which like there was a kind Mickey of a some sort of Disney style Epic Mickey game on the DS.
Yeah, Epic Mickey that was on Wii.
No, there was another one on 3DS. I think nobody played, unfortunately, because there was an option where you could have like Disney characters living in this castle. And I had talked to one of the creators of the game, and he said, yeah.
Power of Illusion.
Yeah, and he said that was it. And he was inspired by Suikoden 2, that idea.
Any game in which you have an upgradable HQ headquarters where your characters are running around and hanging out is okay by me.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I don't much care for the music of the third iteration of that castle, but because it gets really, for some reason, garish towards the second half. But it's a great little base. I named it a swear word, of course.
Of course you did, Nani. So getting back to the 108 Stars of Destiny really quickly, one of the fun aspects of it is recruiting all of them. And it has a little bit of a gotta catch them all type aspect, but it gets quite complicated, right? I mean, there's at least one that requires you to basically trigger a cutscene in a secluded alleyway, and then you have to recruit them before a specific story event, and then a side quest ensues, and your chances of actually fulfilling one of these requirements before you finish the game are pretty difficult. This is definitely a game that you want to play with a guide in front of you.
Yes, yeah, and yeah, you have to do certain things before a certain point in order to get the best ending. There's some obscure stuff you have to recruit. There's a character named Humphrey, and who's the guy who's with them? Fudge.
Humphrey.
You have to recruit the two of them. Yeah, and you have to get the two of them at a specific point, or else you'll miss them. And although you can come back later and get them later, if you don't do them at the right time where you're supposed to, you can't get the best ending, which involves saving Nanami. And so, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that is worth reading. I actually wrote a tips post for Kotaku that you can check out if you're curious about the game, because it has kind of spoiler-free guidelines for, like, here are the things you must know when it comes to recruiting characters. One of them is early on, there's a battle against an army battle, and there's a dude named — the army battles in this game, by the way, are these little Fire Emblem style strategy battles that are pretty cool. There's a dude named Gilbert, and you have to do damage to him in that battle or else he's gone forever.
Right,
that's the only
right
way to recruit him is
that and Clive, I think, the guy from the gun guild, is very easy to miss.
Yes.
I missed him the first time as well.
Yeah, because that involves it checks your timer, how much time you're spending playing the game.
Yeah, this harkens back to a period when I think developers just assumed that you were going to play through a game multiple times because there was no DLC, there were no online hooks or anything like that. So they're like, well, let's try and pack in as many Easter eggs and interesting secrets as possible for people who are playing through a second or a third time can actually achieve. Yes. So it's your impetus to kind of come back and play again. So it's hard for me to hold against it. I think going down the rabbit holes of finding some of these characters is a really rewarding aspect.
Yeah,
of Suikoden 2.
Especially back in the day, one of my another reason I came into Suikoden 2 actually is because I actually used to be part of a guest book, not a message board, a guest book that was based on the Suikoden series, and we used to just talk about video games in general. But it was like, you know, we had icons based on the Suikoden characters, and I actually still have some very good friends from that. We're talking about like the 90s, who I'm still friends with today.
All right, we're running out of time, so let's talk about something that we often hit on with these more story-driven RPGs, which is the best moments. And we already talked about the big fight with Luca, which I would say is one of the top five moments in RPGs. But Jason, what to you is a best moment in Suikoden 2?
Oh, man. Okay, so the best moment is the thing that cemented this game as the best game of all time for me. And this is incredibly spoilery, so by now, if you're not already prepared for spoilers, here's your last warning. So at the beginning of the game, you and Joey, the main character, your main character and Joey, his best friend, you are kind of fleeing from this camp of this soldier group that you were both members of, and you've just seen something horrible happen, and you're just like, we got to get out of here, we're gonna run. And as you're running, you get to this cliff point, and then you both inscribe your, like, you slash your swords on a tree, and you're like, if we ever get separated, we're coming back here. And then you both take this leap off a cliff, and you might think that at that point they'll get separated and they have to come back there, but that's not what happens. What happens is they both wind up washing up at the same place, at this mercenary fortress, and then the story unfolds, and I won't get into everything, but at some point, and after a few hours later, Joey betrays you, and then you guys are completely separated. You wind up both becoming the leaders of these two armies that are going at each other and destined to fight one another. And you go through the game 40, 50 hours later, the entire game is over. You've defeated Joey's army. You've gone to his castle. You've beaten the final boss, which is this big true rune monster. And then you're left with a decision. Do you want to stay and become the leader of your castle and your army and your kingdom, or do you want to leave? And if you stay, then you get one ending and kind of the bad ending of the game where you become mayor and leader of your city, of your country. If you leave, then you can go and explore the world. And if you explore the world, you might remember a little moment from one of the first things you saw in the game where you guys both slashed that tree. And you have to kind of come to this decision on your own. Like, the game doesn't tell you anything or even hint anything. But if you go and explore the world and you go back to your homeland, your original country where you were fighting the soldiers, and you go find this tree, you will find Joey standing there. And that is how you get the best ending in the game, is by going and remembering that that's where you promised to meet up if you were ever separated, and going and uniting there. And I won't get into all the nitty-gritty details, but I remember first discovering that was one of those moments for me that was like, holy shit, like, this would not be possible if it weren't a video game, because it gave me the control and me it tasked me with figuring out that I had to go and do that. And that to me was just like a really special moment, and that is always the thing that sticks out to me, that ending of the game, of just like going and reuniting with your friend all these hours later and just finding yourself back at the same place where you started.
Yeah, I see that as kind of the canonical ending, the normal ending as being kind of canonical, because by the time you get to that, there's so much blood and terror and like really bad things have happened that it almost feels weird to give particularly Joey a happy ending. I've always been kind of like, Joey has to die. Sorry. What about you, Nadia? What's a best moment?
I think for me, the best moment is there's a moment later on in the game where Joey's on your side and you're infiltrating the enemy camp to try to talk to Luca's sister, and it all goes wrong and everyone runs, and Joey's like, you know, go ahead, I'll hold him back. So that happens, and Joey's like, I'll see you again, don't worry. So you can decide if you want to wait for Joey outside of the gate of this, you know, this major capital. And basically it's just this long, slow but really, really emotional event where you, Nani and the little girl that Joey adopts, like, I'll just kind of wait for him. And you see, you know, the sun is setting and they're all just kind of quietly talking about, like, all the moments you had with Joey and just, like, you know, keeping the faith that he'll show up again. And the day just drags on. And eventually he, even though you have the option to go back in at several points, if you stay, you'll eventually see him come, you know, limping back home, and everyone just kind of runs up to him and hugs him. And, you know, he says, oh, it's just nice to have friends waiting for you. And the killer about that moment is, Kat, you were saying about how the developers back then kind of expected you to play through games several times back then, that event happens right before Joey betrays you all. So when you play it again and you know what's going to happen literally the next day in the game, it's just a real heartbreaker.
All right, that's number 5 on our top 25 RPG list, Suikoden 2, a truly remarkable game. Sadly, it was not successful in its own day, but it ended up having many sequels. A lot of people tend to kind of poo-poo the later games, but Jason, I know you're a proponent of Suikoden 5.
Yeah, 5 is great. People should not poo-poo that. People should go play it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the meantime, if you want to play Suikoden 2, you can still play it on the... It's still available through the PSP and the PS Vita, or you can play it on the PlayStation 3. You have to probably go through a little more trouble to get it. It's unfortunate that it's not as widely available as it should be, but it's better than having to download a ROM. But all right, thanks to Jason for coming on the show to talk about Suikoden 2. Jason, is there anything you want to promote on the show really quickly?
Sure. People can find me at Kotaku, and my podcast is Kotaku Split Screen if you want to hear me talk about JRPGs and much more.
All right, thanks for coming on the show, and we're going to head on to the mailbag. All right, as usual, we're going to read comments from the listeners of Acts of the Blood God. And the first one is from Dolrich242. I love hearing Mike in his smooth jazz voice on Acts of the Blood God. It's always refreshing. It was interesting to find out that Mike likes to garden. After that, you mentioned smooth gardening with Mike. I think you need to start a new podcast or stream entitled Smooth Gardening with Mike. The concept of this podcast or stream is just Mike talking about and playing games like Stardew Valley, Harvest Moon, and Farm Simulator, and others of the like. From time to time, you and Nadia can guess, and I know you and her both really enjoy Stardew Valley. It sounds like some ASMR stuff.
It really does, and I actually think Mike would be pretty good at that. I don't know if he likes gardening.
I'm just imagining him going, and now we're going to harvest the parsnips, okay? We're harvesting.
Oh, look at this little
now
lamb.
Now it's time to water them. We're going to water the plants.
We're going to put down some fertilizer. And so on and so forth.
We're building kegs. Oh, God, there's slimes everywhere. What's going on? I'm kind of down with Stardew Valley, by the way. I'm
done
finished.
With it?
Yep. I have accomplished pretty much all of my goals. My character is about to have a baby. I'm married. I've fully upgraded my house. At this point, I'm just making money for the sake of it.
Well, at least you got married. You had your kid. You're good.
Yeah. No. I put a solid 80 hours into this game.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed
good.
It. It is a great damn game.
And for the, I actually broke down and bought it for the Switch again. Because, yeah, I don't think last time I played it, I meant to marry Shane. I didn't get around to it. So I'm like, okay, this time I'm going to marry Shane, that drunken jerk.
Yeah, I think I've said this in the past, but Stardew Valley, while not strictly an RPG, has so many connections to classic RPGs. It has that 16-bit sprite-based RPG look,
yes.
Especially in the way that the characters act. The character archetypes themselves feel like they have sprung just straight out of a JRPG, particular characters like Abigail. And then, of course, the fact that they have things like the Skull Cavern, which is a never-ending dungeon dive. There are plenty of stats to manipulate and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to call it an honorary RPG.
I think that's a good title for it. Did you ever find out about Abigail and her illegitimate ancestry?
Oh, yeah. It was the fact that she's probably the daughter of the wizard or something like that.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? Like, who wants to screw the wizard? He's weird.
It seems to me that everybody in this game has screwed up family life.
They really do, and that's actually an article I wrote on the site. You can look back on it, dear listeners, if you want to, just about like how Stardew Valley is filled with small town scandals, and it delivers them really well. It's a really fun game. I think it's written really well.
Henry Keith says, "Hey there, I enjoy the fresh takes the Godblood serves up every week, but I never have felt compelled to write in until the touchy matter of Final Fantasy VIII being good came up." Final Fantasy VIII was the first RPG I played to really seal the idea that story can happily take a backseat to great gameplay mechanics. It wasn't just a junctioning of spells to stats and resistances that one could employ. I particularly enjoyed the ability to compile resources via multiple routes, via compellingly collectible GF abilities, to synthesize weapon components and rare spells and into triple triad cards that had me. This meant that fun card game distractions had real utility in the greater gameplay. I was fascinated. While the story, particularly Squall's sulky bitterness and that amnesiac plot twist, were disappointing, I found the character design of the antagonistic sorceresses to be among the series' strongest, particularly the 8-foot-tall, frighteningly anabolic sorceress Adele. The moment when she is released from her outer space suspension into the chaos of the Lunar Cry is one of the most chilling moments I've witnessed in a Final Fantasy game. Yeah, I totally agree. I love the Lunar Cry. Characters like Selfie, Woohoo, and Laguna were also delightful additions to a largely unremarkable cast of characters that gave the story some fun levity and an element of relatability. Final Fantasy VIII is certainly divisive, but largely misunderstood by those who complain about it. I am of the opinion that you may not like the game, but you should certainly respect it. I am all but certain we will never see a Final Fantasy like it again. Yeah, Nadia, you should respect it.
I do respect it. One thing I actually really, really like about the game is the fact that Laguna and Squall are father and son, but they are total polar opposites. And that is not something you see in literature or video games or anything. Usually you have, like, you know, the son who must take up his father's mantle, his father's sword, and, like, you know, I will avenge you. And it's just like, when Laguna and Squall meet each other in Dissidia 02 and they have no idea they're related, they're just, like, so on opposite ends of the spectrum that it's hilarious. And the developers know it, and they're just having a really good time with it.
Well, they do that in Final Fantasy X as well. I know that, I'm pretty sure you haven't played it, but Tidus and Jekt, where
yeah.
Jekt is like the the jock who is kind of a jerk.
Well, that's just daddy issues the game. I mean, Squall doesn't really have, well, I guess he has daddy issues, but he was a, you know, kind of put up for adoption as a kid. So just character, just design-wise, how different they are. And Laguna is such a happy soul, and Squall is Squall.
They never really resolve it either. Like, they heavily hint that Squall is the child, and they do ultimately meet, but it's not like they have a dad, son.
Yeah, yeah, which I'm kind of two minds about that. Again, it's one of those things that doesn't happen in RPGs, so I'm glad they kind of went a different route with it, but it's very much like it's left to the player to think, to kind of think, okay, well, how do they work this out? I know they talked. Laguna mentioned that they have to have a long talk when this is all done, and Kiros says something about how he's lucky he doesn't look, how Squall's lucky he doesn't look like his father, but yeah, it's just, I like the way Final Fantasy VIII handles certain things, and that's one of the things.
All right, do you want to contribute to the conversation? Drop me a line on Twitter. I'm at @_catbot, and my DMs are open. You can also send me an email at cat.bailey@usgamer.net, and you can also drop a comment into the show notes on the site. Okay, Axel Blogout is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Subscribe to our newsletter. You can find links to that on the site. I also fairly regularly post them on social media. So we're going to be back next week. Per usual, we're heading into a fairly busy March, especially with GDC and PAX East coming up. Nadia and I are actually going to get together in PAX East. We got three panels. There's not going to be an Axel and Blood God panel, but we are going to play Dreamcast games, which is pretty fun.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty funny. Been a long time since I played Crazy Taxi, but I love the hell out of it.
And Mike is going to be going through the crazy twisted chronology of Assassin's Creed. And here's an RPG-related one. We're going to ask, what went wrong with Fallout 76, and how can it be fixed? And can it be fixed? That is an interesting question. So all these panels are at PAX East, which is our it's from ReadPop, our parent company. Go and check out all of the info and details about that on their site. Okay. We'll be back next week. And until then, thanks to everybody for coming on the show. And for Nadia and myself, happy adventuring.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem, mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.